Lecture 20, Personality and Self-Control.
One of the biggest psychological differences between human beings and other animals is that we humans are able to exert a certain amount of conscious, deliberate control over our behavior. We're able to contemplate our options and make conscious decisions in ways that other animals can't. And what that means is that we can intentionally decide, at least within limits, how we want to behave. But as we all know, our efforts to control our behavior often don't work. As hard as we might try, we overeat, we lose our temper, we procrastinate, we can't make ourselves exercise like we should. We give in to all kinds of temptations that we know we ought to resist. Understanding how people self-regulate is critical to understanding their personalities. Not only do people differ in how well they control their own behavior, but many of the things that make people different from one another involve how they manage their behavior and cope with the challenges they face in life. Importantly, how good people are at self-regulation is also an important determinant of the quality of their lives. For example, self-control promotes achievement and success. As a university professor, it's obvious to me that most students who do poorly in my classes could do the work, but they're having problems with self-regulation. In fact, one study found that self-control was the only personality variable among 32 variables studied that significantly predicted grade point average among college students. And in early adolescence, self-control predicts class grades even better than intelligence does. High self-control also helps people get along better with others. Self-control can help people refrain from doing things that might hurt their relationships with other people. Whether it's blurting out hurtful things or losing one's temper or telling a secret or having an affair. Even in childhood, kids with better self-control are more popular and have higher status among their peers. People who are better at self-regulation are also better at avoiding things that will hurt them in the long run. People who aren't good at controlling how much money they spend end up with financial problems. People who have trouble behaving themselves end up with legal problems. People who don't get things done at work get fired. People who have trouble resisting sexual temptations damage their close relationships. People who have poor self-control tend to eat more and drink more, and they're more likely to take drugs. Of course, most of us have occasional lapses in some of these areas. But overall, people who are good at self-regulation are happier and healthier and even live longer than people who are bad self-regulators. Of all of the aspects of personality that we've discussed in this course, self-regulation ranks near the top in its overall importance in people's lives. Having good self-control doesn't guarantee that a person will be successful or have good relationships or be healthy, but the chances of having these things without good self-control are very low. To understand how personality relates to self-regulation, let's think about what self-regulation actually is. At its foundation, self-regulation involves how people manage the process of pursuing their goals. Self-regulation is all about goal pursuit. We all have many goals in life. Some are ongoing goals that stretch out over time, such as the goal to be financially secure or to get an education or to be healthy. Other goals are momentary and fleeting, such as when we have the goal of finding a parking place or mowing the yard or getting to a meeting on time. At any given moment, many goals can be potentially active. But there are limits on how many goals we can pursue at the same time. I can't mow the yard and do my taxes at the same time. And sometimes our goals directly conflict with each other. A person on a diet has the goal of losing weight, but may also have the goal of enjoying the food at a party. A student might have the goal of studying for tomorrow's test, but also want to socialize with friends and get enough sleep. I may have the goal of saving my money, but also the goal of buying something that I see in the store right now. We can't do everything, and we can't have everything. So how do we manage our behavior in ways that achieve our goals and maximize our happiness and well-being in the long run? People who are good at self-regulation manage their behavior in pursuit of their goals better than people who are bad at self-regulation. So the question is this: what aspects of personality help people pursue their goals in a way that maximizes their ability to attain them? Usually, when we think of people who have poor self-control, we think about people who can't stop themselves from behaving in ways that create problems for themselves or other people. The kid who can't stay in his seat in class, the person who can't resist sweets, or the person who spends too much money. These people seem to struggle with the ability to inhibit or resist impulses that are inconsistent with important goals. They're bad at what we'll call self-control by inhibition. They have trouble inhibiting certain problematic behaviors. Well, that's obviously an important aspect of self-control. But as important as inhibiting yourself from engaging in undesired behaviors is the ability to make yourself take action and initiate desired behaviors. There, the question is, to what extent can a person consciously make him or herself behave in ways that achieve important goals? An employee needs to start the project at work. A student needs to sit down and study. A person who wants to stay fit has to make him or herself get out the door to work out, and so on. This type of self-regulation is called self-control by initiation. It involves initiating behaviors that move us toward a goal. Of course, these two types of self-regulation tend to go together to some extent. People who are good at initiating behavior also tend to be good at inhibiting behavior, and people who are bad at one also tend to be bad at the other. But self-control by initiation and self-control by inhibition are not as strongly related to each other as you might expect. So some people are good at controlling their impulses to do things they shouldn't do, but they're not very good at initiating behaviors needed to achieve their goals. A well-behaved person may still have trouble with procrastination, for example. In the same way, some people have trouble resisting impulses and temptations, but they still initiate behaviors that lead toward certain goals. Even though they struggle with temptations, they can make themselves do what's needed when the time comes. As we'll see in a moment, different personality variables are associated with self-control by initiation and self-control by inhibition. So you might be good at both, or bad at both, or good at one and bad at the other. Whether we're talking about initiation or inhibition, people sometimes need to control themselves on an ongoing basis rather than just once. The employee needs to work on the task long enough to make progress. The student has to study long enough. The fitness enthusiast has to work out a sufficiently long time. Just running down to the end of the driveway and back isn't going to help. Yet we all know people who are good at initiating or inhibiting just once, but really bad at continuing to initiate or inhibit. To be really good at self-regulation, people not only have to initiate or inhibit a behavior, they have to be able to keep it up. This requires yet another set of skills and characteristics that we call self-control by continuation. So, self-regulation isn't just a single characteristic. It's a set of characteristics and skills that determine how well people initiate, inhibit, and then continue behaviors that help them achieve their goals. The scientific study of self-regulation got its start in the late 1960s with research on delay of gratification in children. Delay of gratification refers to the ability to resist the temptation to settle for an immediate reward right now in order to get some larger or more important reward sometime in the future. Learning to work toward and wait for desired outcomes is essential for achieving most important goals. Freud talked about this 100 years ago, saying that children must learn to, and I'm going to quote him here, renounce immediate satisfaction, to postpone the obtaining of pleasure, to put up with a little unpleasure. In the early research on delay of gratification, which some of you may know as the so-called marshmallow test, young children were shown a small treat. It wasn't always a marshmallow. It depended on what the child liked. It could be little pretzel sticks or a cookie or a few M&Ms or a marshmallow or whatever. The child was told that the researcher was going to leave the room for a few minutes. And if the child waited and didn't eat the treat until the researcher got back, the child would get two of the treats. But at any time while the researcher was gone, the child could ring a little bell that was on the desk and then eat the one treat immediately, in which case he or she wouldn't get any more. You can see how this experimental setup could test children's ability to delay gratification. If they could make themselves wait, they'd get two treats. Or they could have one treat anytime they wanted. Just ring the bell. You can think of this as a test of self-control by inhibition. How well can the child inhibit the impulse to eat the snack right away? Dozens of these kinds of studies have been conducted over the years on children of various ages, as young as 4 years old, and using different ways of measuring delay of gratification. These studies have taught us a lot about self-regulation in childhood. But for our purposes, three important findings stand out. First, as you can imagine, some kids were better at self-control than other kids were. Some kids gobbled the snack up right away, totally unable to delay gratification even for a few seconds. Others held out for a while, but then, ring-a-ding-ding, they gave in and rang the bell and ate the snack. But some kids were able to wait the entire time to delay gratification and thereby get two treats. Even at age 4, there were clear differences in their ability to self-regulate. Second, performance on this simple task was correlated with the degree to which children self-regulated in many domains of their lives. For example, how well children did on the marshmallow test was related to how self-controlled their teachers said they were in the classroom and on the playground, and how much self-control they showed at home. That's important because it shows that the marshmallow task measures some basic characteristics that are related to general self-control. The third important finding was that how well children were able to control themselves when they were young predicted important psychological, educational, and social outcomes both at the time and many years later in adolescence and adulthood. If we simply measure how many seconds a child in elementary school waits before eating the treat, that very simple measure can not only predict reliably how good the child's grades are at the time, but also predict the child's academic performance in high school and how many years of education the child will complete by his or her 20s. Furthermore, the better children are able to delay gratification in elementary school, the fewer risky behaviors they engage in ninth grade. Things like taking drugs, stealing, or doing physically risky things. They also show fewer disruptive behavioral problems. They get along better with other people, and they're less likely to be overweight. And these kinds of effects carry over into adulthood. 20 years after doing the marshmallow test, adults who delayed gratification better as children had higher self-esteem, coped better with stress, were less likely to use illegal drugs, and had lower rates of obesity. People who are generally better at delaying gratification as children fare better in life than those who aren't so good. Clearly, there's some relatively stable personality characteristic related to self-regulation that impacts people's well-being across life. So what's going on here? What underlies these kinds of differences? Well, several things. At the root of all self-control is a set of cognitive skills that are often called executive functions. That might seem to be a strange term, but if you think of what an executive in a company does, you'll get a general idea of what these mental skills do. The job of an executive is to set goals for the company, to develop plans, to make decisions, to monitor the company's performance, and to keep an eye out for problems that could derail progress toward company goals. In the same way, your brain's executive functions involve mental abilities that are involved in goal setting, planning, making decisions, monitoring what you do, and managing behaviors that would interfere with your goals. These mental functions are involved anytime you try to regulate your own behavior. Thinking about self-regulation in this way makes it obvious that several distinct skills are involved. It's one thing for an executive at a company to come up with good goals, but it's quite another thing to come up with plans for how to achieve those goals and then to follow through. And in the same way, self-regulation involves separate mental executive functions. If people are to be really good at self-regulation, they need to be reasonably good at all of these tasks. Self-regulation is only as good as the weakest link in this chain. So if any executive function isn't up to the task, self-regulation will be more difficult and less successful. Significantly, these executive functions are highly heritable, so self-regulation has a clear genetic basis. That doesn't mean that people can't get better at these kinds of skills. Lots of research shows that they can. But one reason that some people are better at self-regulation than others from an early age is that they were born that way. Beyond executive functions that are needed for self-regulation, people differ in other ways that are relevant to their ability to control their behavior. A very important trait that predicts self-regulation is impulsivity. By the time that children are toddlers, you can see differences in how impulsive they are. Some kids run and grab and react without much thought or hesitation, whereas others are more deliberate and controlled. In the same way, some adults are highly impulsive and others are more deliberate. And those who are more impulsive have greater problems with self-regulation. When researchers first started studying impulsivity, they regarded it as a single trait. But as it turns out, impulsivity can reflect several different psychological characteristics, each of which is associated with problems in self-regulation for a different reason. The thing you probably think of first when you think of impulsivity is the tendency to act without thinking or premeditation. People who are impulsive in this way just act on their urges without considering the consequences. They don't stop and think. But some impulsivity reflects an inability to stay focused on what one is doing at the moment. So I'm working on something important, but then something else pops up. My favorite TV show comes on, or a friend calls asking to go out, or I just get an urge to do something else, and I impulsively drop what I'm doing and run off. Another impulsive characteristic involves the tendency to act quickly, with a sense of urgency when something happens. Of course, sometimes urgency is fine. When the house is on fire, it's great. But many times, things don't need an immediate reaction. Some people have a tendency to respond quickly, with a sense of urgency, even when they don't need to react quickly, and it might be better to wait a bit. They're thinking about what they're doing, but they're just rushing things a bit. So not all impulsive people are alike. In fact, some researchers suggest that we shouldn't use the word impulsivity as if it's a single personality characteristic, because there are different sorts of impulsive traits. But whichever sort of impulsivity we're talking about, highly impulsive people tend to have more problems with self-control by inhibition than less impulsive people do. You probably won't be surprised to know that the big five trait that's most consistently linked to self-regulation is conscientiousness. In fact, it's hard to imagine someone being highly conscientious who isn't reasonably good at making himself or herself do what needs to be done. Lots of research shows a strong link between conscientiousness and people's ability to self-regulate. When researchers have teased apart the individual features of conscientiousness to see which ones relate most strongly to self-regulation, two aspects stand out. One is that conscientious people are more likely to think before taking action. They're more likely to plan ahead, and when immediate action is needed, they're more likely to take just a moment to decide the best way to respond, which is obviously an important part of self-regulation. So people higher in conscientiousness are better at self-control by inhibition. The other aspect of conscientiousness that's strongly related to self-regulation is self-discipline, being able to force yourself to act consistently toward your goals. So highly conscientious people are better at avoiding procrastination and at persisting on tasks, even if they aren't going well or are unpleasant. They're not only better at inhibition, but they're also better at both self-control by initiation and self-control by continuation than less conscientious people are. To be maximally conscientious, you have to do what you should and not do what you shouldn't, and you have to keep doing or not doing it. Neuroticism is also related to self-control, but the relationship is complex. Researchers were confused initially because some studies showed that people who are high in neuroticism are better at self-regulation, and other studies showed that they were worse. So, which is it? Well, it turns out to be both. On one hand, people who are high in neuroticism tend to be inhibited and even over-controlled at times. Because they're generally more anxious, more self-conscious, more concerned about making sure that bad things don't happen, people high in neuroticism may try to do everything just right and to rein in any impulses that would lead them to do things that they shouldn't. So they put a lot of effort into self-regulation. But paradoxically, their highly negative emotions can also interfere with self-regulation. All of us have trouble managing ourselves when we're upset. And because people high in neuroticism experience more negative emotions, their ability to regulate is often derailed by their emotional reactions. When they're anxious or angry or distraught or jealous or upset in some other way, their strong emotions can make it harder for them to control themselves. So people high in neuroticism can struggle with self-control by inhibition when they're upset. Not only that, but there's evidence that people higher in neuroticism experience unfulfilled desires more strongly than less neurotic people do. Think about what it feels like not to have something that you want. What most people experience as just a normal desire can feel like an uncomfortable urge, almost like the urge of an addiction, to people who are higher in neuroticism. So when they have the urge to eat something they shouldn't, or buy something that they want, or to smoke a cigarette or have a drink, the unfulfilled temptation is so emotionally unpleasant that highly neurotic people are more likely to give in. So conscientiousness and neuroticism both relate strongly to self-control. What about the rest of the big five? Well, agreeableness also relates to self-regulation. If you think about it, being a highly agreeable person partly involves controlling your negative reactions to other people. Highly agreeable people are sometimes agreeable because they're able to restrain some of their negative impulses, to bite their tongues and to choose their battles, and to let other people's annoying behavior slide. People who don't self-regulate as well have more trouble controlling these impulses, so they end up behaving disagreeably when they have problems with other people. Not surprisingly, agreeableness is related most strongly to self-control by inhibition. Extroversion also tends to be related to self-regulation, but somewhat more weakly. As we saw previously, people higher in extroversion tend to be more outgoing and spontaneous and uninhibited than people low in extroversion. Those characteristics make extroverts better at self-control by initiation. They're somewhat better at initiating actions. But those same characteristics can make extroverts a little worse at self-control by inhibition. They sometimes respond impulsively and spontaneously, which means they sometimes don't regulate as well. In the same way, people low in extroversion, introverts if you will, are better at self-control by inhibition, but not as good at self-control by initiation. So it's a bit of a wash, and the overall relationship between extroversion and self-regulation is weak. And in case you're wondering, openness isn't related to self-regulation at all. Whether people are good or bad at self-regulation, they tend to approach their goals in two distinct ways that have implications for how they pursue their goals and how they react when they succeed or fail at what they set out to do. Some people are motivated to pursue goals primarily by a desire for positive, pleasant outcomes. They're motivated to behave in ways that make things better than they are now. We call these people promotion-focused. They want to promote positive outcomes. Other people, though, are motivated to pursue their goals primarily by a desire to prevent negative, unpleasant outcomes. They're motivated to behave in ways that make sure that things don't get any worse than they are now. These people are called prevention-focused because they want to prevent negative things from happening. So, for example, a promotion-oriented student is motivated mostly to get good grades, whereas a prevention-oriented student is motivated mostly to avoid getting bad grades. A promotion-oriented spouse wants to make his or her marriage better. A prevention-oriented spouse is more focused on being sure that it doesn't deteriorate. A promotion-oriented person wants to be healthy. A prevention-oriented person wants to avoid getting sick. Get the idea? Promotion-oriented people tend to approach their goals with a sense of eagerness because they focus on what they want to get or what they want to have happen. But prevention-oriented people approach goals with caution and vigilance because their goal is mostly to avoid bad things. And in fact, success and failure mean something different to promotion and prevention-oriented people. For promotion-oriented people, success is experienced as a gain, as an improvement or reward. So it results in the cheerful sorts of reactions that people have when they get what they want. But for prevention-oriented people, success is experienced not so much as a gain, but rather as the avoidance of a loss. Success means they didn't fail. They were able to avoid a negative event. So prevention-oriented people react to success not so much with happiness, but with relief. Sure, it's nice I did well, but mostly I'm relieved that I didn't do poorly. In the same way, failure means something different to a person who's trying to succeed than it does to a person who's trying not to fail. For a promotion-oriented person, failure is a failure to obtain some hoped-for goal. I didn't get something positive that I wanted. Success. So their emotional reaction is disappointment or dejection or sadness because they didn't get something positive that they were motivated to get. But for a prevention-oriented person, failure is having something happen that they didn't want to have happen. I got something that I didn't want. Failure. So prevention-oriented people tend to be anxious and upset by failure. Note that the goal itself can be the same. The difference is whether people construe failure as not getting something that they wanted or as getting something that they didn't want. That minor difference has a big effect on how people react to failures to achieve their goals. This difference also affects how people look back on their failures. Promotion-oriented people look back and think about what they should have done differently to improve their performance. Prevention-oriented people look back and think about what they shouldn't have done. In general, being motivated by the appeal of positive outcomes is better, psychologically speaking, than trying to be sure that bad things don't happen. People who have a mainly promotion focus tend to be lower in neuroticism than those with a prevention focus. And being promotion focused is also associated with a lower likelihood of being depressed and with a higher likelihood of being satisfied with one's life. To recap, the ability to manage our behavior is an important determinant of how well we achieve our goals, both big goals like finishing school and saving for retirement, and little goals like getting the laundry done and paying our bills on time. And as we have seen, self-regulation has many implications for our psychological well-being and satisfaction with life. That being said, people can sometimes self-regulate too much. People can be too controlled for their own good, which involves, at minimum, a lack of spontaneity, or worse, a high level of compulsivity. Trying to exercise deliberate control over everything you do is not healthy. There are times in which people ought not to exercise self-control. And the trick is knowing when self-control will be beneficial and when it will be detrimental to one's well-being. So, on top of everything else, people need to regulate how much they engage in self-regulation.